Group meeting, Sunday, 13th December, 1981. So far, we have devoted all our meetings this autumn to the topic of meditation. We have tried to see what is the real meaning of the meditative state, the state which supervenes in clear consciousness as and when all our discursive thinking and verbalizing process stays still. The brain becomes perfectly quiet and still and is receptive to influences and a state of understanding which is transcendent as compared with our ordinary worldly state here. That is the deep meaning of the meditative state. And therefore, what passes as meditation in the ordinary way is not the real thing by a long chalk. In fact, it is completely different from what the true meditative state is. Our ordinary what we ordinarily call meditation is a process of musing. It's a verbal ritual which we go through. The different systems of meditation that are laid down as such are not the reality of meditation. They are like photographs of the living person, and the photographs are not the actual living person. So the true meditative state is something very, very different. But it emerges out of us because it is one of our, one could almost say, divine potentialities with which we are born. It's a potentiality, and the release of that potentiality really means one of the fulfillments of the purpose of our existence. It is only one aspect of the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence as members of the human species. We have looked into that quite a bit, and we have also considered various aspects of ordinary discursive meditation, which is the correspondent, if you like, of the theistic systems of prayer and ritual, ritualistic worship and so on. That is what ordinary meditation is. It has a great value because it is not the real thing. One mustn't think that it has no value. It does have value because, above all, it helps us to learn how to concentrate our attention, to pay attention to any particular subject. Now, this collectedness of one's attention is of the utmost importance where the real meditative state is concerned. That real meditative state cannot supervene unless the power of complete attentiveness has come to full fruition in us. And that complete attentiveness is something which is quite extraordinary, because it is not a case of attending to a particular object of attention. This is the point. The transcendent is so transcendent to all that we know and experience in the worldly state that it is utterly indescribable. So you see, we cannot think about this transcendent state in the manner in which our ordinary thinking about this, that or the other in the worldly state is concerned. That is very important. But the meditative techniques which are widespread in the world are techniques which can be helpful in teaching us to pay concentrated attention, to be thoughtful, not to be thoughtless, not to be scatterbrained. And that is, I think you will all agree, of some considerable importance in our life. Now, today I think we can finish off our considerations on this topic of meditation. Looking into some of the disturbances that interrupt our ordinary efforts at meditation, the disturbances which arise in our own mind and in our feelings and so on. Now, these disturbances are related to what may be called the 10 ways of action which characterize our organisms, the psychophysical organisms, you see. These ways can be presented, of course you can present them in various forms, but this is a useful way of presenting them. There are three of body, three ways of action of the body, four ways of action of speech, and three ways of action of thought. Now the three, there is a dual aspect to them. There are the evil ways, there are the good ways, the vicious ways, the virtuous ways. And it's much easier for us to consider those which are vicious, which are evil, and the opposite will be the good way. See, as far as our ordinary training, the training of our psyche is concerned, and the purification of the psyche is concerned. You may ask, well, why should we look at the evil like that? Why don't we look straight away positively at the good? Immediately, one may ask, well, do we really know the good to concentrate attention upon it? Because if we actually did know it and did live according to it, if our ways of action were good, well, there is nothing to do, so to say. We are already perfect human beings, but we are not. So we don't know the real good, but we do know the flaws in our nature. We know we get angry, we feel hateful, we know we are deluded, we suffer from illusions, we know we are greedy, and greed plays a tremendous part in human life. We know all that, and so those are the things which we can really observe and deal with. The others we can't. That is why one starts, as a person might say, the negative way. The negative way really is the indispensable way for the positive to emerge. The positive is hidden, very, very much hidden by the negative. Now, let us look at the evil things that one does. Put it in general terms. They will correspond to the commandments in terms of the theistic religions like Christianity, and to the advices and so forth in terms of religions like Buddhism and Hinduism. They are advices. And you will see that psychologically there is much greater sense in presenting it in the form of an advice than in the form of a commandment. Because present it in the form of a commandment, and then there is always a state of psychological conflict within oneself. I am doing this, but I ought to do that. You see? And the ought is imposed upon ourselves. It is a command, and there is that in our psyche which, being impure, is fighting against that. So you're in a state of conflict. You're not in a state where you can really understand and heal what is ill, what is sick in the psyche. The healing process is the important thing. So now, let us put it in this form. Onslaught on creatures. This is the first aspect where of the action of the body, related to the body. Onslaught on creatures. That is the form in which Buddhism presents it. The other religions talk in terms of thou shalt not kill. But that is the most dramatic aspect of this onslaught on creatures, harming, harmfulness to all living things, not only human beings, but animals and trees also. And there are so many forms in which this onslaught takes place. There is, of course, war, there is murder, and so forth, and there is also this aspect. The sport which some people enjoy, hunting, fishing, shooting, and all the rest of it. It is an onslaught on creatures. And people do it for their pleasure, not for necessity, absolute necessity. They do it for pleasure, and they take a pride in their skill in killing the unoffending creature. Usually it is an unoffending creature. Then there is the participation in slaughter. We do not directly slaughter here, but indirectly we are responsible if we eat flesh food. We have to kill the animal. Somebody has to kill that animal. Somebody has to catch that fish and take away its life. And the animal may love its life as much as you or I do love our own lives. Perhaps even more, because the animal has... What else has the animal but its own living body? So if one has the sort of sensitivity to be sufficiently understanding and compassionate, that, as far as I can see, is one of the best reasons for avoiding flesh food. I say avoiding, just put it gently, because sometimes it is a necessity for the individual's survival that he have flesh food. Supposing you are living in Greenland, what can you do? You have no option in the matter. Or in certain parts of places like Tibet, there is no option. You have to kill the animal in order to have food for yourself, and so forth. Of course, one may have the impossibly altruistic attitude and say, "Oh, I'll let the animal eat me rather than me eat the animal." All right, do it if you like. But I don't think most people will like that. Now, the next aspect is stealing, theft. And there are so many forms of thieving. We know the obvious forms of thieving. Taking something which is not freely given unto us. We take it away by stealth, because we want to possess it, and so we deprive the other person of his possession, and we deprive him against his will. And if we deprive him against his will, then that is called highway robbery. That's the, I think, legal definition of robbery. To take away by force something which belongs to another person against his will, that is highway robbery. So there is that form of stealing. Then there are various other forms of stealing. We have the phrase, stealing the limelight. Now, that may not sound particularly heinous, but if one looks into it carefully, one will see that there are the feelings of the person whose limelight has been stolen by me. And I have been inconsiderate towards that person, therefore, by my stealing the limelight. You look at a social gathering, we'll say, and the chatter that goes on and so forth. and the way it goes on, and the way perhaps some self-obtrusive person will dominate by with a slightly louder voice than usual, and have the attention of all present concentrated on himself, stealing the limelight. And similarly, there are so many other ways in the business world, or in any aspect of human life, you find that there is this element of stealth coming in, of theft coming in. In competition, there is a certain amount of stealing which takes place. If the competition is strong enough. And the third aspect is the indiscriminate indulgence of our senses, our five senses. Sensuality is usually associated exclusively with sexual sensuality. But that is not the only sensuality. We experience and express sensuality, sensuousness, and the indulgence of our senses in so many different ways. It is necessary to use all our senses rightly and fully. But if we use our senses fully, or very often in excess, in order to give ourselves inordinate pleasure, then we are obviously making a mistake. Take, for instance, the question of food, the sense of taste. We like this, we like the other, and so forth and so forth. We therefore indulge the sense of taste to the detriment of our own health usually. We know nowadays scientifically that food is one of the most powerful influences for health. And if we do not observe the optimum where the quantity of food is concerned, and do not observe the necessity for attending to the quality of the food we eat, we harm ourselves. And in all probability, therefore, we might harm others who may be dependent upon our good health and functioning for their well-being and so forth. There are so many factors like that involved. A great many of them are very, very subtle. And that is why they pass by people's attention. They don't notice it. They do wrong unknowingly, unwittingly. But here I think something which Plato said is extremely useful and valuable for us to remember. He said if a person does a wrong unknowingly and unwittingly, he deserves a heavier penalty than the person who does it knowingly. Because, said Plato, in addition to the wrongdoing as such, there is added the fault of ignorance. He has no business to be ignorant. And you know, our legal systems all over the world do not accept ignorance of the law as an excuse. It's rather a curious thing. Maybe it's partly the influence of those old thinkers who thought in that way. So, this indulgence of the senses is again one of the wrong actions of the body. So we have the three: the onslaught on creatures, harmfulness, theft, and indulgence of the senses. We must discriminate between indulgence and right use. If there is right use of the senses, there will inevitably come great happiness and pleasure. You can't avoid it. If you consider life as such, you in its fullness, you will see that there are innumerable sources of sheer delight which the world is constantly pouring in upon us. And so much of it comes all the time to us that we cannot really enjoy the whole lot fully. It's too much happiness, if you like. And one may mention the beauty of nature. Step out of your front door on a starry night. Perhaps tonight when you step out of because the moon will not have risen then. But yesterday and day before, it was a magnificent golden moon in the sky as you went out of the out of your house or looked out of the window. And things like that come unasked, unplanned, undesired. And then that is the gift of the gods, if you like. And that sort of pleasure is absolute, not only legitimate pleasure and happiness, but it is necessary for the health of the body. We know now that there are what are called the pleasure areas in the brain. And if those pleasure areas are altogether deprived, then the brain begins to suffer the consequences of that deprivation. So there has to be happiness and pleasure. You see, but what we have to beware of, if we intend to live religiously, that is just this: not the deliberate pursuit for self-indulgence. This is the thing we have to beware of. Let us go on to speech. Now, obviously, speech which is lying is evil. Again, speech which is slanderous or spiteful. So that's the second way. The third way, speech which is bitter or harsh. And finally, speech which is frivolous. You consider those points: untruthfulness, slander, spite, bitterness, harshness, and frivolity. Just consider the amount of speech, the amount of conversation which is tainted with these qualities. It's absolutely incredible, really incredible. And the amount of harm done in the world by mischievous gossip and so forth, oh, it has brought about immense tragedy in people's lives. So those are the four aspects where speech is concerned. And then where thought and feeling are concerned, there is covetousness, greed, associated with envy. One sees somebody possess something and wishes, oh, I wish I had it for myself. Why should he have it and I not have it, and so forth. Covetousness has been responsible for a lot of so much ill feeling and ill doing throughout human life. Then there is the aspect of malevolence, ill will, envy, jealousy, and so forth. All those things come under the category of hate. Also, time and again, we express our own egoism and vanity when we feel what we excuse as righteous indignation. Is indignation really righteous? We hear news or we see something being done which is obviously evil. Right? It is perfectly evil. It is wrong. But do I heal that which is wrong with the rising up of anger within myself? I must see the fact as the fact. Yes, this is evil. But if I want to heal that which is evil, I must be in sympathy with the evil doer. That is to say, not the sympathy of saying, yes, you carry on. Not that. But the sympathy of compassion, which sees what an awful thing that man is doing, and it is so sad that he should do it. You see, it's like that. The malevolence is very, very strong all throughout the world. And today, particularly in our own period now, after the last war, the amount of hate and anger which is generated everywhere has been in feeling and thought is responsible for the murder and callous murder which goes on in so many parts of the world. There is no part of the world which is free of this evil now. And we cannot heal it by just righteous indignation or anger against the evil. We say, oh, I don't hate the evildoer, but I hate the evil. Now that is a very, very subtle piece of self-deception. Because supposing there were no evildoer, there would be no evil, and therefore there'd be no evil to hate. When I say I hate the evil, I very subtly identify the evil with the evildoer. So I'm actually hating the evildoer also. And hate never heals. You know that wonderful statement, hatred never ceases by hatred. Hatred ceases only through non-hatred. Some people would like to say hatred ceases only by love. But do we know what real love is? The love that doesn't demand anything, that is utterly unpossessive, that is freely given under any circumstance whatsoever to anybody and everybody. Now this is a very difficult thing, isn't it? So, to put it in the form of hatred ceases only by non-hatred is, psychologically speaking, a very sensible and practical way of putting it. And then, of course, there is the thought which is corrupt, just people whose thinking is a corrupt thinking altogether. And their purpose for action, which of course first emerges in feeling and thought, is a corrupt purpose altogether. So those are the three forms of evil in thought. The good will be the opposite of all this. Giving up, concerning the body, giving up harming, to become completely harmless. Everybody in the world is in a harmless state in one condition. That is, in the state of absolutely sound, dreamless slumber. In that condition, he is absolutely harmless. It's like a child. You watch a child, a little child, an infant or a little child asleep. That child is completely in harmony with the whole universe, utterly harmless, in perfect relationship. That is the state of love, of pure love. That is one example of it. So, the person lives merciful, kindly, compassionate. Where speech is concerned, he refrains from speech that is lying, slanderous, spiteful, and so on. And his speech is actually gentle. It is pleasing to the ear. It is affectionate. It goes to the heart of the speaker. It promotes concord and makes for peace, for reconciliation and for peace. That is the speech he utters. All other speech, he refrains from all other speech. There is so much low conversation, frivolous speech, foul speech, ugly speech, which bedevils the atmosphere, the psychical atmosphere in which we live. And speech is so very important, because speech plays the greatest practical part in all human relationships and in human activities. We tell each other what to do, we see what we want done, etc. We listen to another person telling us what he wants done for us. If I am his employee and he is my employer, he tells me what he wants done. Well, speech plays the most important part in our ordinary practical life. That is why speech is so very important. Where the mind is concerned, he is not covetous. He is never envious. He is never jealous. He doesn't compete with anybody or anything. Because competition means an imposition of the self, oneself, as being better than so and so and so and so. Strive for the best, of course, for the optimum. Strive for the best, but without any thought of being better than an other person. Because that otherness which is introduced into one's psyche thereby is a source of evil action. When we as human beings are really perfected human beings, we will never compare anything. Because that perfection does not admit of comparison. You look at the way people argue, who wrote the better symphonies, Beethoven or Mozart or Brahms or anything. Absurd nonsense. Perfection is perfection. Put it in another way. You find a young man swearing that his sweetheart is the most beautiful girl in the world, and his friend will swear that his sweetheart is the most beautiful girl. Both are swearing the truth. No one is more beautiful than another. If there is real love, real understanding, real humanity, humanness in its full sense, then comparison is out. If the religions of the world, if the political, economic and other systems of the world could observe that sort of thing, would there be wars and destruction and so forth going on? Would there be? It wouldn't. It's as simple as that, but of course the simple things are amongst the most difficult to perform, that we know. You take a great fugue of Bach or something like that. The structure is really very, very simple. The principles underlying that fugue are very simple. The fugue itself is complex. The actual notes composing the fugue and so on. That's very complex, but it is not complicated. That which is complex, but in principle utterly simple, is healthy, is whole, is holy. Whereas when complication sets in, then there is illness and misery and suffering and so forth. This is something which people don't take sufficient count of. So, those are the various aspects of the disturbances related to the 10 ways of action which can interrupt our effort at ordinary discursive meditation. And one may ask, well, what is the solution to it? Supposing I'm meditating and some evil feeling or thought comes and interrupts me and spoils my meditation. Well, one can put it very, very simply in the words of Jesus, for instance. He said, watch and pray, for you know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. Now note very carefully, the Son of Man, the word man means, is from the Sanskrit root mind, man. Man is the Sanskrit root from which our words man and mind are both derived. The son of man is really the son of mind, of the divine mind. Look at that other statement. For God so loved the world that he sent his alone begotten son. Now, that alone begottenness is not the result of fleshly begetting, obviously. But the mind of God, as such, is the perfect mind. Is the absolutely transcendent and perfect mind. You see, all right. He sent that mind to redeem mankind, to save mankind as such. That means that in the person whose psyche is absolutely purified, who is the sinless one, that divine mind has begun to function freely and unobstructed by the living person himself. So the son of mind simply means just this divine potentiality in us come to fruition. He sent his alone begotten son. Now if you look at it that way, we will see something of the real meaning of Christmas. The Buddha put it in the two phrases, samasati and samasamadhi. That means perfect mindfulness and perfect communion. If you are perfectly watchful and pray in the supreme sense, which is you are in communion with the supreme reality, with the divine itself within you. The divine within you is completely at one with the divine in throughout the totality. So samasati and samasamadhi, they are the Buddhist correspondent of the watch and pray of Jesus. So now, Christmas celebrates the birth of Christ. Note carefully, not so much the birth of Jesus, as the vast multitudes put it, but the birth of Christ, meaning the Christ consciousness. That Christ consciousness is the consciousness which represents this atonement of one's own innermost consciousness with the divine consciousness as such, with the divine mind as such. You see? And it signifies the birth of that and the emergence of that consciousness. And it is the power of that kind of consciousness, we'll put it in Buddhist terms, the power of the Buddha nature which comes to fruition in you, which is really the power that can salve mankind. And it salves oneself first, and it salves all those who are in relationship with you, whom you love and who love you, and so forth, you see. And this is the real happiness and joy and merriment of Christmas. Not the merriment that people indulge in, get drunk and whatnot, and then have car accidents on the way home and so forth. See, it's not that merriment. It's a totally different merriment. It's a joy which bubbles up from within, from a bottomless spring, a fount which never fails, and which spreads throughout the whole cosmos, actually. We don't know these things. We don't see these things. But if one really understands how he can purify his own psyche and learn to enter the meditative state, these things become a reality in his life. And that happiness, which, as far as I can see, is represented by Christmas as such, you see, is the sort of happiness I wish all of you with all my heart for this Christmas and for all your Christmases to come. And see to it that every day of your life becomes Christmas. Thank you.